So I always ask ourselves two things. Is the algorithm going to actually reduce racial disparities and bias? And can it be also used to increase the trust of families, of the system as a whole, by being a better and more transparent tool to allow people better insight into what is being done?
I'm JB Wogan from Mathematica, and welcome back to On the Evidence, a show that examines what we know about today's most urgent challenges and how we can make progress in addressing them. Maybe it's just my social media feeds, but I seem to come across a new story every week about the promise or perils of organizations, be they hospitals, the courts, or banks, using computer algorithms to make predictions. On this episode, I talk with three researchers who are helping child welfare agencies in the U.S. use algorithms, or what they prefer to call predictive risk models, to inform decisions made by human case managers and their supervisors. My guests are Rima Vaidyanathan, Emily Putnam Hornstein, and Beth Wiegensberg. Rima is a professor of economics in the School of Social Sciences and Public Policy at Auckland University of Technology, New Zealand. She's also the director of the Center for Social Data Analytics. Emily is an associate professor at the University of Southern California and the director of the Children's Data Network. Beth is a senior researcher here at Mathematica with me. Rima and Emily have already worked with Allegheny County in Pennsylvania to implement a predictive risk model there that uses hundreds of data elements to help the people screening calls about child abuse and neglect better assess the risk associated with each case of potential maltreatment. Now they are working with two more counties in Colorado to pilot a similar predictive risk model there. Last year, they initiated a partnership with Mathematica to replicate and scale up their work by offering the same kind of assistance to states and counties around the country. We'll get into how Rima, Emily, and Beth proactively try to address common concerns about using algorithms in public policy, but I should note at the outset that they are advocates of making algorithms transparent, subjecting the use of algorithms to independent evaluation, and paying close attention to ethical issues, such as accounting for racial bias in the data. We recorded this conversation in December 2019, and I think it bears mentioning that in late February, Emily and Rima appeared in The Trials of Gabriel Fernandez, a Netflix documentary series which tells the tragic story of an 8-year-old California boy who died in 2015, but not before enduring abuse by his mother and her boyfriend. The series raises questions about the child welfare system's failure to protect him and its capacity to protect other children. In early March, it was the most popular original series on the streaming platform. Our conversation is almost entirely focused on a potential solution for avoiding tragedies like what happened to Gabriel Fernandez, or at least making those cases much less likely to happen. I hope you find it useful.
Rima, Emily, Beth, thank you so much for coming in today.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Okay, so today we'll talk about the use of predictive risk models in child welfare and how to do it in a way that is both fair and transparent. But before we dive into that discussion, let's give our listeners a little context. Why are some child welfare agencies and researchers and other policymakers interested in a different way of identifying when children are at risk of maltreatment and would likely require government intervention to keep them safe? Why was change needed in the system?
So historically, we've thought about the number of children who are involved in the child protection system from the perspective of the system. So we kind of count it up annually, and the numbers are large. We see that there are around 3.5 million calls that come into our child protection hotline and around 6 million children named as potential victims of abuse and neglect. But I don't think that we've previously appreciated the extent to which the child protection system touches and interacts with families. And recent national research led by Chris Wildeman and other colleagues has documented that around 12% of American children are substantiated as victims of abuse and neglect at some point between birth and age 18. But perhaps even more shockingly, more than a third of American children experience an investigation for abuse or neglect. So I think one of the things that has happened over the years is that every time there has been a child tragedy that we have somehow missed, the response has been to make the front door of our child welfare system just a little bit larger in the hopes that we would see and catch and identify and protect that child. And the result has been that we have effectively flooded our hotlines and flooded our child welfare system with calls, but have not evolved and equipped the front end of the system with the necessary risk assessment and risk stratification approaches. And that's an area where I think looking at how some of these same challenges of triaging and risk assessment have been addressed in health and other sectors can really inform our thinking as to what's possible in child protection.
Just to pick up on two ideas there. So there's problems with false positives and false negatives where you have the agency sometimes or too often they think there's an issue but there isn't one, and then and a family's investigated and there's that burden of both the agency and the family. And then there's also times where the case is missed, where they don't investigate or they don't end up taking action, and then they regret it afterwards because there's some sort of negative outcome. Is that roughly correct?
I think that's exactly right. And I think that those types of missed opportunities to deliver services and preventative interventions, while also not stretching the system so thin so that it's kind of intervening with families that may not need it, is a fundamental challenge.
Okay. Yeah, because when the system is bringing in one in three American kids at least once before they turn 18, they are going to naturally have a lot of noise to signal ratio because the majority of children that they're investigating are completely and absolutely safe. And yet, so it's a very much a needle in a haystack, and all we're doing is bringing more hay to these investigators and to their supervisors. So if you're a supervisor with under-resourced, overstretched caseworkers, how are you going to decide which of today's investigations you're really going to focus in on? Because the chances are most of today's investigations are investigations into families who really don't need it. But there is that one investigation where increased alertness, increased services could really make the difference and change the trajectory. Now, as a supervisor, you come into work in the morning, you have very little idea which of today's cases you really should be focusing on.
All right, so we'll talk about predictive risk modeling as a tool for child welfare caseworkers in a moment. But in places that don't use predictive risk modeling, what do caseworkers do instead?
So in jurisdictions that have not adopted more automated predictive algorithms, one of two things is generally the status quo. Either workers will simply gather information over the phone and make a determination as to whether or not this meets some statutory definition for investigating. And then during the investigation phase, the worker will kind of use their clinical judgment to determine what level of services may be needed. So that's still taking place in some jurisdictions. In other jurisdictions, they will use what can be thought of as actuarial tools. And by an actuarial tool, what I mean is a tool where there has been a statistical model built to try to distill critical pieces of information that should be gathered. And that is then used to make an assessment of future risk of harm and to determine the level of services needed. So, for example, I can tell you that in California, there is a risk assessment tool that's also used in dozens of other jurisdictions where at the conclusion of an investigation, a worker is asked to basically complete a checklist for around 16 different items. And based on the completion of that checklist, a family is assigned to be low, moderate, high, or very high risk. And that then maps to whether or not a case is opened for services.
One of the limitations of these sorts of actuarial tools, where the caseworkers have to sort of basically fill out a tick box form, is that often those tools are very restrictive in the number of elements that they can bring to assessment, because obviously a caseworker doesn't have a mountain of time to fill those out. So typically there'll be anything from a 7 to 12 assessment items. That means that we really risk those tools being biased, being leaving out certain aspects of a person's history, and in particular overemphasizing some elements that might have some bias in their history. The other element is that these are not validated often on the population they're used for. So we're finding actuarial tools often used internationally, which are validated for a very specific jurisdiction in some part of the world, and yet they get flooded, the system, right around the world, and no one asks how valid is it for the population that I'm actually using the tool on. How well does it perform against predicting critical events or even predicting further involvement in child welfare? The other thing that people have found with sort of more in-depth studies of how workers are using these tools is oftentimes they are filling the form out after they've made a decision. Because oftentimes, whilst the theory of the tools is that the worker fills the answers and then the tool helps them decide what they should do, in actual fact, they're so pressed for time, there are so few slots for workers to send a child out for investigation or for other services, that they're ending up making the decision and then going back and filling out those forms in a way that justifies their decision.
Mm.
And this is a real danger that you don't get when you use the kinds of automated tools that we've been deploying in systems, because those tools automatically go and harvest whatever data sets that are already in the system and are known about the family. Rather than 7 to 12 elements, they'll bring 300 elements together. And there's really nothing that the worker can do to change that number, because that number is just based on validated risk scoring from the population that it's being used for. And at that point, of course, we always encourage the workers to make their own decision to investigate further with elements that the tool might not have had access to talk to supervisors. And of course, they make a judgment. It's sometimes called human in the loop. We want the human in the loop to be the final arbiter of the decision. But these tools, these automated tools, are validated for the population, do not have the possibility of being subverted by workers providing different answers, and are fast and really require no worker input.
If I can just add kind of a very concrete example that always sticks in my mind. I remember early on after the Allegheny Family Screening Tool had first been implemented, and Rima and I were back and had an opportunity to speak with some of the hotline workers who had been using it. And not surprisingly, change and adopting new tools can be slow and there can be some resistance. But my memory is of a worker who said that in her mind, the best part of the Allegheny Family Screening Tool is that in the past, what she would have done was to hear what the caller alleging abuse or neglect communicated, look at the data, and then go discuss whether or not to investigate with her supervisor. And now, in addition to that, she was receiving a score that presented a likelihood of future system involvement for that family. And what that meant was that if she already felt like this was a high-risk situation that needed to be investigated, then receiving a score that kind of conformed with that assessment was a nice gut check. But that in the cases where she had determined something was low risk and the score indicated it was high risk, she knew that before going in to present her recommendation to a supervisor, she needed to delve more deeply and intentionally into the data and the history to understand why there was kind of this disconnect. And the same was true when she assessed that something was high risk and the score indicated it was low risk. And so she actually framed it as, you know, it's one part the score, but it's another part that the score helps me figure out when I need to look more deeply into the data, because I can't go in and talk to my supervisor with a score that is inconsistent with my recommendation and not explain why that is.
Mm-hmm. I just want to piggyback on what Emily was saying. I think when I first learned about what Rima and Emily and others were doing in Allegheny, the social worker in me always would wonder, well, what is the role of the score and what is the role of the screener or the frontline person making the case decisions? And for me, learning more about this process, I keep hearing about these wonderful stories like what Emily just said, but also about you're not replacing good frontline judgment. You're actually adding in a very useful and rich data tool to help them make good frontline decisions. It's never going to replace that human element, that human, you know, component to the decision, but it's adding to that and helping support them in ways where they often feel like they're overworked, overwhelmed, have lots of information, and how do you sift through that quickly to make good decisions for the kids that they're working with.
Okay, so we've already previewed this question a little bit, but I did want to make sure that we were very clear about what we mean when we say a predictive risk model. What are we predicting? What is the risk? And how certain are those predictions?
Theoretically, there are sort of three ways that we can make decisions in health and human services. One is what's called clinical judgment, where a social worker or caseworker takes, you know, understands all the elements in the current case and uses their judgment and their history to make a decision about screening in or screening out a child or whatever services to provide. The second is using actuarial tools, which are structured questions that the caseworker or the clinician can ask themselves or ask the patient or client, and then work their way through that tool to provide some guidance on what they ought to be doing. The third way, which is being increasingly used in healthcare and now we're bringing into child welfare, is to have an automated tool which sits along with the social worker, the clinician, the caseworker, and draws together in an automated fashion everything that's known about this situation, including the history of the family, the history of the child, the circumstances surrounding the current event. So these tools are really case-based reasoning, but not case-based reasoning of a few, which is what a clinician can do, but case-based reasonings of hundreds and thousands or a million of cases. And these millions of cases come from historic data and are what we call data that was used to train the algorithm. So the algorithm is trained using hundreds and thousands or millions of previous instances. And so when it comes to a new case, it can use that history to help the social worker and guide them as to whether cases that look like this were very high, very medium, or low risk of the event that the algorithm is trained to predict. And so when you say it's trained to predict an event, it's basically a way of saying it has been trained on research data and been learned from that research data the elements that contribute to a child having a particular thing happen to them in the next 12 months or 24 months. And in Allegheny, that outcome is placement or removal from home because of risk and safety concerns.
Just wanted to add something to that, which is while the algorithm has been trained to predict future system involvement, including the likelihood of a future foster care placement, these models are not being used to make a decision as to whether or not to remove a child. Rather, what these models are being used to do is to say, historically, these are exactly the type of children who would have been placed, and these should be the children and families where we should target our preventative interventions so we can prevent a placement from happening instead of waiting for multiple calls to come in. And that's really the idea, that these models can be used to support better risk stratification and more intentional prevention and preventative interventions.
Okay, so that's what we're talking about when we talk about predictive risk models in general. But what about the Center for Social Data Analytics and its approach and the way it's worked with Allegheny County? What's different about the work that you're doing in this field?
So I think the Allegheny Family Screening Tool, and we have subsequently replicated that in two counties in Colorado. We've been working with Douglas County, which is in the outer suburbs of Denver. Since the start of the year, they've been using a similar tool. And we're just starting a new implementation in Larimer County, which is also close to Denver. And all three of those implementations have received a lot of positive feedback, mainly because we, as a research team, which is the Center for Social Data Analytics and the Children's Data Network, have really committed to a set of guardrails and principles right from the start. One of those, as we've already said, is that these tools will always be used in conjunction with welfare, human decision making, that is, with social workers and caseworkers making the decision. We've also really emphasized transparency. We write and publish a lot of technical reports about the tools. In particular, we also show whether those tools have got racial bias, age bias in them, and we are very explicit in addressing issues of bias in these tools. We also have developed a kind of ethical framework, which has been helped for us by an independent ethical researchers who provided ethical guidelines of the use of these tools at screening. And we also have independent impact evaluation. So both Allegheny Family Screening Tool had an independent impact evaluation done by colleagues at Stanford, and the Colorado Denver Douglas County use case is being evaluated by colleagues at Cornell. So we've always encouraged the use of these sort of guardrails to ensure that there is a strong internal coherence to our research program. But I think what's been most important for us is that we've been very open to the community and stakeholders. We've always engaged with them, listened to them, and been very accessible to both media, communities, so that people feel like they really get answers about what's happening. It's done completely in the light, and I think that's really important. And we're very honest with people about what we find and what we are worried about and what we try to address.
So without naming names, could you, that sounds like the way that one should do this. So why is that different? What's different about the ways in which predictive risk models have been used in other places, either in child welfare, or I know it's also being used in criminal justice, for example? What's sort of the contrast there?
So I think one of the most important differences is that with each and every jurisdiction, even though we're coming in as researchers and doing kind of the research and development phase, all of the intellectual property belongs to the public sector. So the models are not proprietary. And what that means is that there's much more both short-term and longer-term accountability for their classification accuracy. And as Rima mentioned, it also really enhances the opportunity for community input and transparency. I think in other sectors, and again, it's understandable why this would play out as it does, but there are technology and other consulting firms who come in and spend the time building a model, and they want to brand that secret sauce as theirs and theirs alone, and that makes it really hard to have the proper levels of oversight and accountability.
Okay. And if I remember correctly from reading some stories in the popular press, there have been issues where there's community distrust because people don't know what's in that secret sauce and aren't sure if it's the way that they would have built the algorithm, built the rules, where they're worried about biases and other things.
And rightly so. I think in a lot of cases, there hasn't even been public transparency or accountability for the classification accuracy of these algorithms. These algorithms will always make errors. They're not crystal balls. But there's some very important ways that from a fairness and an equity standpoint, we need to assess how those errors are being made across different groups. And I don't think there's been enough transparency on that front either.
Okay. So in Allegheny County, you not only developed the risk prediction model, but then both you and the, I guess, independent evaluators have been looking at the impacts. What have you learned from, or what have we sort of collectively learned from studying the model over the last 3 years?
I think the thing that really surprised me the most is that the tool was being used, the tool was making a difference in the decisions that call screeners were making. Because as I said, we emphasize so much that at the end of the day, it's a call screener decision, that I really thought that they would really not use it as much as they have. So you can really see a sharp change in decision making. It's not a one-to-one. It's not to say that every time a child is scored a high risk, they're screening them in, because they're not. About 25% of the time, they're actually not screening them in. And every time a child is low risk, they're screening them out. They're not. They're often screening in children who are low risk. But definitely we have seen a statistically significant change in how they're responding to both high and low risk. And that has led to two things according to the evaluators. It's increased the sort of efficiency of screening. That is, they're more likely to screen in children who subsequently need more activities like cases and services. And it's also reduced racial disparities. In particular, they have started screening in more white children who needed more services. And this is possibly because previously they found it more difficult to see risk in white families. They were screening them out more frequently. And after the score came in, because there were still white children who were scored a high risk score, the call screeners were more responsive to that score amongst those families and were screening them in. And so it reduced racial disproportionality of screening decisions.
Okay. So Allegheny County, I know from my previous career as a reporter and writing about human services, that Allegheny County comes up a lot as kind of a rock star county across the country in terms of its data integration efforts. And so one of the things I wanted to ask here was, you know, is every county in the state or country in a position to integrate and use the data sources that Allegheny County does? And do the quality and range of inputs matter in how accurate the predictions will be? So I guess what I'm asking here is Allegheny County sort of an outlier or a representative of what other counties can do in the predictive risk modeling game?
So undoubtedly, Allegheny is an outlier among jurisdictions for having the wealth of integrated data they do. Frankly, it's also probably an outlier in terms of the strong leadership they've had in the county and the trust they've been able to create with the community that allowed for innovations such as this to be tested and explored. But yours is exactly the question we had, which is there any opportunity to think about similar models being built and deployed in other jurisdictions that may not have that wealth of data? And that's an empirical question that is perhaps still unanswered in its entirety, but I will say that the work that we have done in Colorado, the work that we have done in California is still at the just research phase, would suggest that even if a jurisdiction has nothing more than its historical child protection records, so no data from other sectors, that data can be brought to bear and used in making more accurate and equitable risk assessment decisions. So the work that we've done in California, we've used nothing other than child welfare data, but we've also been able to compare the accuracy of predictions made through just an algorithmic process versus those done through a traditional risk assessment tool, and the algorithm outperformed across every dimension.
All right. So whenever I'm reading an article about predictive analytics these days, it seems like there's always a paragraph or a section that is about concerns over bias. Do you worry that predictive risk modeling may be perpetuating or even amplifying bias? And how do you try to account for those concerns?
So I think those are very legitimate concerns. And I think the answer to that is very specific to a particular use case. One of the commitments that we have made is to always be very open and transparent about exploring the role that including either race in the model directly or other proxies for race produces, as well as looking at how well calibrated the model is from a fairness standpoint in the accuracy of the predictions it's able to make for groups that have been historically overrepresented in the child protection system, including African American and Native American children. But what I always come back to is that we need to remember that our child protection system is being asked to make really, really critical decisions every time a call comes into the hotline, every time an investigation takes place. And human bias is also a real thing. And so I don't think we should hold out these models as things that are by any stretch free of bias. But I do believe that these models can also help us to surface where there may have been bias in historical practice so that we can address that more intentionally. And I'll give you a very specific example. The research that we've done in California, we were able to look at how the model performed across different racial ethnic subgroups, African American children, white children, Hispanic children. We saw that the model performed equivalently across all three groups. But then we did something else. We looked at some of the historical decisions we'd made about who to screen in or not when calls came into the hotline. And what we did is we looked at the lowest risk children and we pulled out those low-risk African-American, low-risk Hispanic, and low-risk white children. And we said, how many have we been screening in? And what the data would suggest that in historical and current practice, we are systematically screening in more low-risk children of color than low-risk white children. And at the other extreme, we looked at the highest-risk kids, and we said, how many of these kids are we screening in or screening out? And what we saw there was that we were systematically screening out more of the highest risk white children. So again, that's an example where do we need to be mindful that some of that bias may also be operating in the current algorithm? Absolutely. Can we also use the algorithm or tools like the algorithm to figure out how we try to change and course correct so that there is more accountability and equity and standardization to our decision making? Absolutely.
Can I just also add that work we've also done using kind of community participatory methods to understand how communities of color and families who are some part of child welfare system view algorithms came out with a very interesting finding, which is that the use of the trust that communities have towards these algorithmic tools are really dependent on the trust that they have of the child welfare system as a whole. And I think that's really important to remember that these algorithms aren't seen by communities in isolation of the trust or mistrust that a lot of families of color have on the child welfare system. So I always ask ourselves two things. Is the algorithm going to actually reduce racial disparities and bias? And can it be also used to increase the trust of families of the system as a whole by being a better and more transparent tool to allow people better insight into what is being done. So I think those are two pieces. It's not just about being more trusted. It's about being also seen to be trustworthy.
I think that's a really good point. Again, it's a question of, on the margin, can these types of tools help us to make better and less biased decisions? Not, are these tools going to solve everything? And again, if we are talking about the child welfare system, decisions have to be made. It's a question of the extent to which we use data in that decision-making process.
Okay. What do you think it would take for the kind of approach that we see in Allegheny County and some of the other places you're already working, for that to become kind of the standard across the U.S.? And kind of in addition to that question, for those who say, well, we're in a jurisdiction or we don't have the money, government, we work in government, we don't have the money, we don't have the personnel with the proper data science expertise to do this ourselves, what options are available to them? What, you know, how do you make this kind of standard practice in child welfare agencies around the country?
I actually think that the most critical piece is that there is a commitment from leadership within public child welfare agencies that they want to bring the latest data and technology to the front end of the system. I think that an unfortunate reality is a lot of attention is paid to initiatives and activities once children have entered foster care, but there's been far less attention paid to how the system responds to the much larger number of children and families where there may be some concerns about safety. And I think that if there's a commitment to look again at how decisions are being made, the answer will undoubtedly point them towards these types of predictive risk models as a best practice. And my hope is that we see more and more jurisdictions following in the heels of Allegheny and Colorado and other states that are kind of being innovative and proactive in exploring this.
When I read about criticism about predictive risk models in child welfare or criminal justice or other areas of public policy, typically what I'm seeing is a concern raised about the potential costs of implementing this new tool in government. But I thought it would be helpful to also talk about what the costs are of inaction. What's the counterfactual? What happens in a world in which child welfare agencies don't make use of predictive risk models?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, as you become comfortable with these tools at the front end, what it can do is safely reduce the amount of investigations you're doing. It's a pathway to safely reducing investigations and safely providing services to reduce removals. It's about everything we always talk about, which is the right service for the right people at the right place, the right time.
I would also say that I think there's a cost in terms of child safety. And I think that we try to avoid sensationalizing this or making it about child protection or child death or near fatalities too heavily. But the work that we've also done to validate that while these algorithms are predicting future system involvement, that system involvement does in fact mean something and is a proxy for more objective measures of child safety, we've done that work with hospitalization data in Allegheny County, with death record data in California. And what we've shown is that these models are highly sensitive to kids who experience near fatalities and fatalities. Now, what does that mean? I don't think it means that if we deployed these models, we would prevent all child deaths from occurring by any stretch. But what it does show is that if we deployed these models, we would be identifying and serving exactly the children and families where these tragedies are most likely to happen. And that's clearly an improvement over what we have today. It's not perfect, but again, on the margin, child protection would be improved.
It does seem like a lot of the discussion ends up being about concern over the economic or social costs of introducing the algorithm rather than what are those costs with the existing system. So I thought it was worth just sort of comparing the two scenarios. So what's next for you and your work in the child welfare field using predictive risk models?
Yeah, I think that we have two really strong use cases for predictive risk modeling at the front end of the system, using it at Hotline, using it for the team decision-making process. I also think there are incredible opportunities to think about using it as a workforce training and a supervision tool. One way to think about it is that practice errors are inevitable, whether it's failing to follow up with a collateral contact who was supposed to be spoken to during an investigation, or inadvertently failing to check a box on a risk assessment tool. And I think that these types of models at the front end of the system can help us to catch when those practice errors are being made in more high stakes or complex cases, where 99 times out of 100, an error will not be tragic or even consequential. But for one in 100, we want to make sure that we have all eyes from a risk management standpoint. So I think that's another area where several jurisdictions have reached out with interest in thinking about that kind of workforce and supervision support approach.
I just want to add one more perspective to think about in terms of next steps or the evolution of using predictive risk models in child welfare. In addition to what Emily already said, is I work a lot with states who are trying to improve their child welfare data systems. And a lot of times people want to find the fast tool, the fast solution, the fast analytic solution to try to give them a new data point to make a decision. And one of the things that I truly value about the work that Rima and Emily have started, and we're hopefully going to continue to grow with them, is that it's much more than just the algorithm and the data point. It's the importance of good, as they put it, guardrails for development and implementation. And so as we work with states and counties in different capacities and talking with them about the potential use cases, about leveraging some of the existing but potentially new data systems coming out in child welfare, how do you do this work carefully and thoughtfully and well with all of the guardrails that are so important in this space, community engagement, transparency, ethics? And for me, a lot of that is education. A lot of that is, you know, one-on-one conversations with communities who are express interest, but some of it's also, you know, having podcasts like this to talk about some of the importance of this work and the cautions that need to be there, and being able to continue to have those dialogues with child welfare agencies and other leaders as people consider how to do more of this work.
Beth, Emily, Rima, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to our guests, Rima, Emily, and Beth. On the text summary of this episode, I will include an issue brief they wrote describing their work on predictive risk models in child welfare. I'll also include an excellent New York Times Magazine piece that takes a deep dive into the Allegheny County model and provides personal anecdotes from people on the ground there. Finally, I will include a link to the publications page for the Center for Social Data Analytics with more information about the Allegheny Family Screening Tool. As always, thanks for listening to another episode of On the Evidence. If you're new to the podcast, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also help others find the show by rating and reviewing us on iTunes. One last way that you can keep up with the show is by following me on Twitter. I'm at JB Wogan.